Fellow members, we continue our study together of this mysterious process of the emanation out of the Absolute under the direction of divine intelligences of universes, solar systems, planets, beings, including men. And we've got to the point where we saw that the whole process is assisted, as it were, by certain orders of the angelic hosts. These are hierarchical in their nature, with vast and mighty archangels, the seven mighty spirits before the throne, at the very summit of the hierarchy, and grade upon grade, in a descending order, lesser and lesser beings, until at last we come down to the non-individualized sylphs and mento-astral angels, and eventually to the little nature spirits themselves. Although little, remember, they nevertheless, even if unconsciously, play important parts in the production of physical forms and their gradual polishing, beautification, and perfecting, as it were, as it might be said. Of course, they don't know what they are doing. They are within the consciousness of their great senior, and in a way merely follow, as if in play, the one divine idea with which the archangels and angels are themselves united, and of which, in a way, they are expressions. Now, let us look at this idea a little more closely. How do the greater and lesser gods perform their functions? How do they work? Well, I offer a suggestion, and remember, it is a suggestion only. And it's this: they work not from outside entirely, but rather by unifying themselves with the outpoured word force, particularly with such streams of emitted power as are vibrating at frequencies which are identical with those of their own nature. And by thus unifying themselves with the thought word force, they amplify and augment its form-producing power, as I have been saying. And thus, gradually, the divine thought becomes materialized, as it were, or manifested in substance of grosser or denser character, until at last it is manifested down here in the physical world. As I've said, matter resists tremendously, and the process is, in our terms of time, very slow. The first forms are crude, but there are orders of building angels vibrating on the frequencies of God's thought, and they hear this outpoured vibrating song or energy. They hear it as the call of their own nature, and thus they are drawn into the outpoured stream. They become one with it, share their own self-conscious nature with it, so that down here its form-producing power is enhanced. For you know, within the order of the builders are hierarchies which are themselves as a whole, and as individuals, angelic manifestations of those chords of the creative word of which the archetype and forms our expressions. If this is true, then apparently God creates at least doubly in this respect. The Logos produces angelic creations according to the Word, and form creations according to the Word. And these two coalesce, as far as I've been able to understand it, as the will, thought, sound, force. Think of those four words as hyphenated, will you? As the will, thought, sound, force, or word, comes down diagrammatically, and the presence of the building hierarchies established within it enhances the power of the word to build the forms. How simple that may sound. How divine, wondrous, complete are the creative procedures, even thus perceived remotely. This affinity of vibration draws the particular hierarchy into its appropriate field of work as form builders in the four kingdoms of nature: earth, water, air, and fire. Thus, excuse the repetition, there is a hierarchy of building angels, form producing, if you like, the cord of whose nature is identical with certain aspects of nature herself. Wondrous beings they are, shimmering throughout their iridescent auras with flicks and flashes of the life essence outpoured from the divine source and manifesting divine thought as a living order of beings, vast angels of God. Now, to continue the study a little further, we come to the work of the fairy builders of form, the Sephiroths in miniature, the building angels to be. For, of course, the nature spirits are evolving, and their destiny is, like that of our animals, birds, etc., to become individualized into individual beings, as man is, this making him distinct from the subhuman kingdoms of nature. Similarly, as far as I understand it, in the angelic kingdom, the nature spirit and lesser angels are all evolving into an individualized condition when they will become arupa angels and eventually great archangels, mighty spirits beside or before the throne of God. But we are looking at them in the lower orders. For the ultimate fashioners of physical forms according to divine thought are, I believe, members of certain orders of nature spirits. Chiefly, I think, of the element of earth, gnomes, brownies as they are called. And these are assisted by those of air, fairy, and sylph. Gnomes would seem to be associated rather with mineral forms, fairies and their seniors with plant forms. But remember that all unconsciously, these little creatures aid the great designer, universal thought, by playing, as it were, in the geometrical fields of force set up by the impact of creative energy as sound upon responsive, fructified matter. In those lines of force, there is for the nature spirits a kind of exciting electrical energy, and they are attracted into it. They run and play and dance back and forth and across the lines in rings, circles, chains, rather like dancers. They feel stimulated and even intoxicated by this unification of themselves with the creative word force and the patterns that it makes in etheric matter, each one, of course, outlined by electromagnetic form-producing energy and even sound. And this it is which gives to the nature spirit such intoxicating joy, a characteristic of their word and their world, and enables them all unconsciously, whilst playing and dancing, to increase or enhance the strength of those lines of force along which the substances of physical matter will be drawn to produce nature's physical forms. Now let's look at that a little more closely. I know it's rather complex. Well, something like this. The establishment of fields of force of varied geometrical designs occurs as the word force impinges upon the prepared, fructified etheric substance. It strikes not primarily dense substance, but first of all the ether, which is both mold and matrix of all forms. For remember, the etheric double of the world is Mother Nature's womb. Pleasure is gained by the nature spirits, as I've just said, in moving, leaping, running, dancing, and flying along the fields of force and the lines of energy within these fields. And this fairy motion, which has been glimpsed and caught sight of by seers of all ages to produce the folklore of the nations of the world, this fairy motion accentuates these lines in the ether, establishes them, as does a pencil drawn over and over again along the lines of a diagram. That, it has seemed to me, as I watch them hour by hour, is what they are doing, although they don't know it in the very least. When I first began to watch and ponder over their play, trying to find out what it was all about, I asked them, or one of the more awake and alive members of groups, what their purpose was, but they couldn't tell me. I saw that they didn't know. They had little or no mentality, were moved by instinct and the search for joy, and, of course, the direction of their seniors. But all they knew, all they felt, was that they were happy in an exciting stream of joy, which was God. And they danced and flew along the lines of force, where the joy-producing power was at its height. Some of them also absorbed the emitted creative energy and vitality to the limit of their capacity to contain it, and then in a kind of lightning-like explosion they discharged it, thereby rendering matter more responsive to the ensouling life and word force. This very imperfectly perceived and described, this is part of the great work. But for them, it is all a great game, a spontaneous play, a mounting ecstasy. And that I found when I tried to touch their primitive minds or germinal minds, that was all they knew. Since, however, all elements meet at the physical level, all nature spirits of the four elements thus assist in the manifestation of nature under the direction of their seniors, the angelic hosts. Thus, in Hinduism it is said that all nature, plants, flowers, lakes, waterfalls, mountains, and fields. All these, they say, are but the auras of the gods made visible. This is a beautiful and, in one way, a not untrue idea, for the little workmen are everywhere and ceaselessly at work, which for them is play. And as far as I have found, no smallest form of any kind appears unassociated with a fairy builder of form. In none of these, however, can a thought of self possibly arise, for individuality is not born in them. Inwardly moved by the action within them of universal thought, which is their mother source, remember, they engage in thought-free, spontaneous play within the currents of creative energy flowing through them and all about them in their subtle element, the etheric double of our world. Now let me just sum up that part of our study together. Something like this. The creative idea is first conceived in universal mind and then expressed as celestial sound, spiritual music, if you will, and this emitted celestial sound, expressive of the creative idea, produces forms in matter, from the highest right down to the etheric and physical worlds. In the ether, the fairies, the fairy people, dance to the divine symphony of creation, a pastoral symphony, I always think of it, and in consequence, in part, nature's forms gradually begin to appear. Are we getting too far away from the realm of scientific thinking and of the ideas of modern science itself? No, at least not from the thought of some scientists. Not of all, however. A certain Dr. Kennedy, not long ago, wrote these words: "The notion of space empty or space ethereal has today been abandoned, and nature is now viewed as energy patterned into worlds, patterned variously for every stick, stone, or bit of life upon them. Man thus becomes," he wrote, "one with his environment, which pervades him wholly and into which he extends himself hugely. Born according to his manner, he holds his unique pattern as a momentary opportunity for experience, a stream of creative continuity with aim." Close the quotes. There, friend, you see, is a remarkable statement. Life, and the life in man, is described as a stream of creative continuity with aim. And Dr. Kennedy continues, "Anywhere where vitality exists, aim is found. A primitive consciousness exists as purpose in every living cell and organized itself as structure." Then Sir James Arthur Thompson, in his book The Great Design, writes, "Throughout the world of animal life, there are expressions of something akin to the mind in ourselves. There is, from the amoeba upwards, a stream of inner subjective life. It may be only a slender rill, but sometimes it is a strong current. It includes, says Sir James Arthur Thompson, it includes feeling, imagining, purposing, as well as occasionally thinking. It, this is the universal mind, it includes also the unconscious. And you will remember that Sir James Jeans, in his book The Mysterious Universe, says this: "To my mind, the laws which nature obeys are less suggestive of those which a machine obeys in its motion than those which a musician obeys in writing a fugue or a poet in composing a sonnet. The motions of electrons and atoms do not resemble those of the parts of a locomotive so much as those of the dancers in a cotillion. And if the true essence of substances is forever unknowable, it does not matter whether the cotillion is danced at a ball in real life, or on a cinematograph screen, or in a story by Boccaccio. If all this is so, then the universe can be best pictured, although still very imperfectly and inadequately, as consisting of pure thought, the thought of what, for want of a wider word, we must describe as a mathematical thinker." How near the great astronomer comes, doesn't he, to our theosophical view? For if to this idea of a mathematical thinker, expressing the thought of the universe, if to that concept be added the other one of individual intelligences, archangelic and angelic embodiments of the great thought, then all that is written above might well have been expressed by an exponent of occult philosophy. It is, however, but just to quote also Sir James Jeans' further words. He says that everything that has been said and every conclusion that has been tentatively put forward is quite frankly speculative and uncertain. I myself echo those words, though not a great and famous scientist, in all that I venture to put forth in my studies of this great subject of the life in all nature and the processes whereby nature's forms are produced. Now let us continue, after that slight digression, with the subject of this particular thought. We have seen that the form-building process appears to be assisted by the actions of hierarchies of creative intelligences, certain orders of the archangels and the angelic hosts. These are embodiments of the universal thought. They know the design and the archetype, and they ally themselves or unify themselves with the word force. Thereby, and excuse the repetition, they enhance or amplify its formative capacity, and that, I believe, is the key to the understanding of their work. These beings live in the superphysical worlds, and they act perpetually as form-molding agencies according to the word. In the East, as we've just seen, certain of them are called Gandharvas, angels of music, though we should think less of our human music and more of the ever-chanted divine name, the creative word. In the Vishnu Purana, one of the Hindu scriptures, we read that they are said to have been born from Brahma, imbibing melody, drinking of the goddess of speech were they born, and hence their appellation, Gandharvas, angels of music. Such beings, from our theosophical point of view, are Arupa Devas, being denizens of the Arupa, or formless worlds. This means those planes of nature more subtle than that at which the formal mind of man usually functions. What do they look like? Well, I've given pictures of some of them in my book, The Kingdom of the Gods. To clairvoyant vision, they resemble centers of consciousness and force, from which brilliantly colored radiations extend on every side, though a faint suggestion of an idealized human-like form is definitely received. In bringing the result into the brain-mind, the vision can become materialized, formalized, and so marred. However, the whole canopy of heaven, the limitless hemisphere of visible space, and of course in the higher consciousness, the whole sphere of visible space is seen by the student to be filled by great choirs of the Gandharvas, the angels of will, thought, sound, as I think of them. I realize that I'm materializing the concept, but I can't help it. Let me continue with the description. In the inner Arupa worlds, there appears in this region of divine being and consciousness, there appears to be a vast orchestra and choir of angels filling all space, gathered in tiers, as it were, arranged in groups, each with its own characteristic colors and cosmic chants, and so areas or parts of the emitted creative power. Every atom of the auras of these beautiful beings is glowing, shining with the appropriate hues of their particular chord of existence, and the space all around them is shimmering with the iridescent radiance of their auras and the effects of their songs upon the surrounding elemental essences. Vast areas, differently colored, fill all space, and in them such countless myriads of winged faces and shining beings are seen. One meditating upon this vision gains the concept that a mighty, inconceivably glorious power, a Mahagandharva as it were, whose aura encloses, fills and energizes them all, and whose consciousness enfolds them, exists as their great Gandharva Lord. He might be thought of somewhat as a conductor, keeping the whole vast hierarchy as absolutely at one, and presiding over these interior formative activities. Order after order, color after color, chord after chord, constantly sound, resound, and echo forth, it has seemed to me, the music of the creative word. Invisible, in higher unattainable realms, the divine singer himself forever chants from dawn to eve. If, further, the mind of the observer is allowed to roam and the consciousness lets itself go, human ideas inevitably obtrude themselves into that higher world, so that these beings can actually seem to be playing on musical instruments. Some of these resemble long funnels, like celestial trumpets, held between the lips of the Gandharvas. A concentrated flow of sound rushes down them in clarion tones. Others seem to sing with their mouths, and one can thus see why the great painters of old portrayed certain orders of angels with coloured robes, winged, and with musical instruments. In truth, when one attempts to bring these great formless, causal concepts down to the level of the formal mind, they tend to become materialized, shaped into familiar, concrete forms. This tendency, of course, must be resisted, and the consciousness maintained as far as possible in the untranslatable and incommunicable reality of those higher worlds, wherein it has seemed to me great choirs of angels ever chant and perform the great symphony of creation. The majestic music, even that word seems to be a materialization of the idea, but I must use it. The majestic music, expressive of the divine idea, thus comes forth from within these lofty realms down to the lower worlds of form, the rupa planes, as they are called in Sanskrit. There the appropriate angels receive, and as I have said, re-echo it, till it is heard at the astral level and influences the elemental essence there to assume certain forms. Again it is re-echoed, and again slowed or stepped down, as I have said, remember, until at last it reaches the etheric world and causes etheric matter, nature's womb, to begin to assume shapes and beautiful designs. Magnetic fields of force containing geometrical plans, designs, are set up in consequence, and these are the fields of force along which physical nature builds the shining garment of the one supreme singer of all. As I've just been saying, the nature spirits play in these lines of force, thereby increasing their formative tendency and assisting in the building, atom by atom, molecule by molecule, and cell by cell, of nature's physical form. Then, in part, and only a very small part, as I am so strongly aware, such appears to be one aspect of the great procedure of creation.